it's a project without, Canadian forces don't fire a gun in Palestine, but they're the most important element in a project that fires many guns and is carrying out a brutal repressive apparatus designed through and through to overthrow a democratically elected government. And so Canada doesn't have to fire a shot for it to play the identical role as if it were. And so I'm just going to take a minute to set the scene, how we came to this this change in eras in Palestine as well. The first Intifada in 87 to 92 was a political protest movement that was dealt with through active warfare. And then once there is a stalemate, diplomacy. So you go from the warfighting terrain to the diplomatic terrain. It's a constant in world affairs to carry out this way. So the first Palestinian intifada, which was probably the third or fourth actual Palestinian intifada against the Zionist project, but it's called the first intifada, that required Israel to take the political conflict and move it into the diplomatic arena, which we saw in the Oslo peace process, which was famously said, or should have been famously, but was nevertheless said by Shlomo Ben-Ami, who was the lead negotiator for Israel, that the efforts of the Oslo peace process were to create a system, he said, of permanent neo-colonial dependency. So from the Intifada, you have this move to the Oslo peace process to create permanent neo-colonial dependency for the Palestinians, something less than a state, but maybe, you know, with lapel pins and stamps and flags flying, but no independent foreign policy, no military, no borders, you know, no independent economy, but some sort of, you know, state minus, right? And of course, we saw that, you know, spectacularly fail in October of 2000 with the second Palestinian Intifada, which rages for 3 years, and you know, there's not enough minutes to talk about all of these things, but it was a brutal war suppressed by Israel from the first day. The first day of the second Intifada continued from the last day of the first Intifada. So the introduction for Israel in the first days of protests were to meet popular protests with helicopter gunships and with tanks. That was the first time Palestinians had seen helicopter gunships used against populations. And actually, if you look into the LexisNexis database, there's actually some amazing stories that came out in journals that you wouldn't expect to have stories like that, like the Edmonton Journal or the Vancouver Sun or whatnot, with headlines like Israelis deploy helicopter gunships against protests. You know, it was a wire story, something they didn't think it through. And they make these kind of headlines that within a few years were, of course, obfuscated into something like, you know, Hamas did something in the headline, and then you read on that actually, you know, 30 Palestinians died and no one even was hurt on the Israeli side. But at first, these headlines were saying, you know, that these were the first times that the helicopter gunships were used. And so that intifada rages, and as the stalemate hits in 2003, 2004, Israel is trying to again move the project back into the diplomatic arena, where it can postpone a settlement while it continues to build its state. And to do so is the real linchpin of my talk, and I think something that's very important to understand in Palestine and here at Apartheid Week is a very important narrative to understand, because I'm going to take the apartheid, which is considered, you know, a provocative term, where people say, you know, well, it's about South Africa and there's, you know, things that are different. Apartheid is a core of Israel's political project. Not the provocative term, if there is a non-provocative apartheid term, but apartheid is an Afrikaner word that means separation. And separation is the core of the Zionist project. And that's what you see when you see the Israelis asking Hamas to recognize a Jewish state. They're not asking them to recognize a democratic, liberal, whatever. They're asking them to represent a Jewish state in a land that is 50% Jewish, 50% Arab. And so the apartheid analogy is not provocative. It's actually the core of the conflict from the Israeli perspective. So the shift happens, and the operation to create the program to create Ghetto Palestine, which I admit does sound like a provocative term, But I live there, and so I live in a ghetto, and I feel that gives me the right to come home and say that I live in a ghetto, even though my work in this region has shown me time and time again that the disconnect between what I witness every day on the ground and what I come back and am told is controversial is ever widening. So the reality is that I live in ghetto Bethlehem. I live in a city that's completely surrounded by an 8-meter-high concrete wall with sniper towers with only two entrances and exits that are checkpoints. And if you were to fly over it, as I don't know if people saw Michael Ignatieff's quote that has been going around over the last little while from 2002, where he was writing in The Guardian as a Harvard professor, and he said, my friend, took me for a flight. You know, he's got friends in Israel that take him on helicopter flights over the West Bank. And he said, I looked down, and what I looked down at, this is as a supporter of Israel. He said, what I looked down at was not the future of a state, but it was the Bantustans from South Africa. And again, it sounds provocative, but that's exactly what it is. If you were to fly over it, if you want to break it down anecdotally in the question answer period, it's the craziest state in the world, where you have Palestinian ghettos and Israeli fortresses on hilltops. You have three or four different levels of citizenship within that model, and some of those levels of citizenship involve not even the use of the word citizen of any state, right? Palestinians famously, infamously, don't have passports, so they don't have the ability to travel with any kind of normal document. They travel with these crazy plastic folders full of documents stamped by three different governments and whatnot. And this is the apartheid analogy is the core of the state. And Israel comes up with this in 2003 during Sharon's regime, and as the Intifada is waned, the suicide bombings have stopped, and Israel is trying to shift the conflict into the diplomatic arena. And it does it by floating, Sharon does it by floating a trial balloon through Ehud Olmert, who became prime minister in Israel, but at the time was foreign minister and held a separate portfolios in the strange parliamentary system that Israel has. he was Sharon's number one deputy at the time. And so rather than Sharon coming and sticking his neck out with a new plan, he got Olmert to do it and to float this plan. And he floated it in an interview in Haaretz, the leading liberal Israeli daily, and it was called, the headline of the article was with quotation marks, and it was called Maximum Jews, Minimum Arabs. Okay, and it was an interview about this new policy, which the headline alone should be enough to justify calling it Apartheid Week and moving on. Maximum Jews, minimum Arabs, which has been an Israeli policy all along. In fact, it's actually the left-wing Israeli policy, separation. The right-wing is ethnic cleansing, and the left-wing wants separation. And the left-wing in Israel, which is as bad as Canada's left and right political spectrum is, Israel's just moved the whole chart right over. It's off the charts. The Labour government is as right-wing a government Harper conservatives, and it's considered the left in Israel. So he floated this trial balloon in this article, Maximum Jews, Minimum Arabs, where he says we're getting to a crisis point here in the state of Israel. He says, with the failure of the Oslo peace process, the Palestinians are more and more, he says, uninterested in a two-state solution. Why? Because they see that their state is going to be a ghetto state, where each city is separated from the other and connected with a tunnel or a bridge or something. And so increasingly, people don't, Palestinians are less and less interested in a negotiated two-state solution. And what he says, crucially, is that there's a shift underway right now that we need to subvert, which is a shift away from what he calls the Algerian model of national liberation struggle, that is, the natives expelling the colonial occupier. And he says there's a shift to the South African model, which is, one man, one vote, civil rights struggle, effectively. And Olmert, you know, in this article, which I feel like if you were ever only going to read one thing about Israel and Palestine, read this Haaretz article from 2003, October 2003, called Maximum Jews, Minimum Arabs, and it's the whole core of the conflict, right in a nutshell. Israel is afraid of what it calls the demographic bomb, the idea that the Jewish population is going to be a minority in the land historically called Palestine. And were this to happen, this would, of course, remove the legitimacy for the state of Israel and all its international backers as the only democracy and yada yada, because everybody will plainly see that a minority is lording over a majority that, incidentally, is growing at far greater rates than the Jewish minority, which is very much a sort of Western capitalist kind of post-industrial state where they have 1.5 kids max or whatever, right? While the Palestinians are having very large families and keeping that community element of the large families very much in place. Even if you don't want to include the West Bank and Gaza, even if you want to just include, you know, Israel proper, the Arabs will outnumber the Jews inevitably in modern political future. You know, so you know, you could say 100 years, but it'll be less than. But it's not like in some, you know, in 2325 or something. Like, we're talking very soon. And this demographic crisis is, according to the Israelis, the death of the Zionist project. It's the death of their state enterprise. Because their state is not about self-determination for Jews in an area of the world where they maintain the victories of the Israeli state, the revival of Hebrew, the social and cultural revival that happened with the state of Israel. For the Israeli construction of Zionism in the 20th and 21st century, it's an exclusively, if not homogeneously, Jewish state. That is the definition of Zionism. It's not simply a binational project where you go and live in a state. You have to control that state under a certain paradigm of Zionism, which involves a racial supremacy for one group of people over the other. I think this term is important. The Israelis aren't anti-Muslim or anti-Arab or whatnot. Their project is a supremacist project. It's not an oppressive project. In that sense, what I mean is they're trying to issue super rights, not to remove rights from another. So for example, within Israeli documents, it doesn't say Arabs and Jews. It says Jews and non-Jews. This is a very important distinction when you see things coming up like Palestinians not being able to work anymore in Israel, and so Israel has had to go to South Asian exploitable migrant workers. But that creates the exact same problem because these Thai workers want citizenship and they want their kids to go to school and they want to go to the hospital when they get sick. And now all of a sudden, the non-Jews, it doesn't matter if they're Thai or from Mars, they're diluting the Zionist project, which is goal is an overwhelmingly, if not homogeneously, Jewish state. In fact, they keep statistical attributes of that state. And you can see them in core planning documents. Like if Jeff Halper was here, like someone said recently, he's got in his office the Jerusalem planning documents that say we're going to maintain a 68-32, Arabs to Jews to Arabs balance in the city, in perpetuity, regardless of what happened. So that's how you get redrawing of borders. That's how you get the settlers driving out Palestinians from their homes, is to maintain this structural apartheid, right? And even if you don't use it in a pejorative, it's a separation. And so Olmert says that shift is the most important thing that needs to be undermined. How do we do that, he says? A number of ways. The first way, we're going to build a wall. We're going to build a wall. We're going to build it around Palestine. And we're going to withdraw. We're going to remove our settlers from the Gaza Strip, where 5,000 of them live amongst 1.5 million Palestinians. So believe it or not, when Sharon colonized Gaza, he believed that if they put enough fields or whatever, had enough organic crops, that Jews would move to Gaza and outnumber the million refugees that live in the Gaza Strip, which seems at this point crazy, but that was the intention. So remove those settlers from Gaza. You know, wash our hands, Israel said, wash our hands of Gaza, and you know, get rid of 1.5 million Palestinians that are deluding the state of Israel, to get rid of the control of those people. So that's when the disengagement, the whole disengagement project of 2005, was part of this Ghetto Palestine project. And the goal, explicitly stated, was to wall off the West Bank and create in the West Bank a series of Gaza Strips. And I live in one of them in Bethlehem. Qalqilya was the first one in the north. There's one in the north that doesn't have concrete walls around it, has electronic fences because it's